I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Alina Scheim. She's executive director of IMPACT. It's a nonprofit organization that teaches violence prevention and self-defense. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So it turns out, I mean, I've taken the IMPACT safety course, the self-defense course, and you've taught many, many people, young people, adults, boys and girls, all kinds of folks in the Santa Fe area, in greater New Mexico. It turns out that there is, in certain segments of society, controversy about self-defense, whether learning self-defense is a good thing or not.
Mm-hmm. And it's nationwide. It's not just local. The controversy is particularly in domestic violence and sexual assault circles. There are concerns primarily because self-defense has been done in ways that have been validly concerning in the past. A lot of times, as the domestic violence and sexual assault movement was getting started, folks were aware of violence against women and volunteering to help out by teaching self-defense classes. And the instructors typically were men who were from martial arts, police, or military background. And understandably, they had a lot of expertise in those areas, but they didn't know anything about trauma. They didn't know anything about women's experiences and how violence against women happens, socialization. So those conversations, when they started, were not very informed. And as a movement, there was resistance to it, to say, you know what, this went really badly. We don't want this here anymore. And besides, gender-based violence is a social problem. It's not an individual problem. So we don't want the onus to be on women to stop it. We want to work with men and to change it so that violence doesn't happen. And what we would say at IMPACT is that's why our style of violence prevention, what's called empowerment-based self-defense, which incorporates the context, the social context, and how violence happens, how socialization happens, understands trauma, understands that violence has affected many of us very greatly. That's how we got started. And that it's important to work on both. You know, we all want a better world. And in the meantime, I would say I want myself and the people that I love to be able to have skills to deal with situations that do come up in the reality that we currently live in.
Yeah, I mean, violence isn't going anywhere anytime soon.
No, it's not. And that's why it's not an either or, but a both and. You know, we at IMPACT, we also do violence prevention classes, what's called primary prevention, where we're working on changing the culture, teaching boys about how to occupy those spaces and how to negotiate consent. You know, we collaborate with Solace and other organizations in the state. And it's important to be working on changing both of those things. And meanwhile, yeah, of course, we want our communities to be able to deal with this. Otherwise, I want the culture to change, and yet I still have some very significant things to grapple with, which may limit me and how I live my life, which is something I don't want.
So when you talk about empowerment-based self-defense, what are you talking about? What does that look like? What does that feel like?
Mm-hmm. Empowerment-based self-defense is a concept that has been around for quite some time. It got developed just as the domestic violence sexual assault movement. In fact, it grew from the same people. And so it's understanding that the context in which sexual violence happens, what are the power dynamics in society, what are ways that there's systemic oppression against women and girls and other people that actually puts them at greater risk for violence? How is violence actually a tool of social control and oppression, not just some random thing that happens, right? It also understands that violence, unfortunately, happens most of the time by people that we know. So it wouldn't be appropriate to teach a self-defense class that is purely physical skills for a situation on the street. We need to be practicing skills for people that we know that are going to be in familiar environments. So at IMPACT, one of the things that we're really clear about and have become more and more clear about is if we role play a scenario in which we're doing a situation with a stranger, you know, I ask groups, I say, you know, most violence happens by people we know, and yet most of the safety advice we're given is about strangers, right? Don't talk to strangers, look under your car, right? Don't go out late at night. all of those pieces of advice are about strangers. So why is that? And right, we talk about denial and we say, okay, so at Impact, we actually start off in stranger scenarios and then move into people that we know. Why do you think we do that? And everyone knows, they go, well, that's easier, right? You can build the skills when you don't have all those emotions connected to it of, oh, I don't want to hurt someone that I care about. I don't know what he'll think about me if I say no so strongly. And then we can switch and move into people that we know and know that those skills are transferable.
So what do the skills look like for dealing with strangers on the street, even though, as you say, that's a more rare occurrence?
Mm-hmm. So in all of our classes, we're looking at avoidance, we're looking at escape, we're looking at accessing help and bystanders, and we're also looking at verbal and physical strategies. And so the verbal strategies can range from de-escalation, setting a clear boundary, empathizing with someone, right? The range is quite fluid. And what's fantastic about that, when you talk about that being able to be transferable to someone that you know, if my only tool is to ignore someone on the street, and that's what I've been told as a child, don't talk to strangers, or as a woman who's being harassed, don't respond, keep walking. And then I'm suddenly in a situation with someone who I'm dating, or, you know, a schoolmate who is talking with me aggressively. I don't have any tools. And so that's what's great, is those verbal strategies transfer. And then the physical strategies, it's unlikely that you would use them, but they can make it feel less of an issue to use your verbal skills, knowing, because for most of us, we have that, well, what if it gets worse? So if you have an answer to that question, what if he gets more angry, you're more likely to be able to say, oh, now I can tell him I'm done with the date and I want to go home.
Have you had feedback from people who have taken the classes and then used those skills, particularly with people they do know, whether it be mm-hmm. family or dating situations?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think probably the biggest piece that we're told is, you know, I talked with a woman who had so many abusive, she was in her early 20s, had so many abusive relationships already by that time. And she said, after taking the class, she went on a couple dates with someone, and early on, he didn't respect her boundaries around her body. And she said, you know what, I decided to not go on more dates with him. And obviously, it's a lot easier to make that sort of shift after 2 dates than it is after 20.
I think it's such a kind of mysterious thing that women who were, for example, assaulted as girls or sexually abused as girls both attract and are attracted to abusive partners when they get older. It's like something gets established that I don't know how that works, but like an abusive man can spot a woman like that a mile away.
Mm-hmm. I think I certainly have experienced that as a survivor myself, and my experience after Impact was that I could still spot them. I was no longer interested in them, and now I don't spot them anymore. If you asked me to, I could, and they don't see me anymore.
And they don't see you anymore. That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So a shift occurs that is palpable mm-hmm. in the real world.
It is. And, you know, I mean, I think it's complicated whenever we have these conversations, because at the same time, we don't want to put the onus on the woman or on the person being targeted. And at the same time, it's true that repatterning is critical for all of us who have experienced violence, right? Perpetrators typically have also experienced violence. And so it's a pattern that's built in anyone, how they were raised, what they perceived as normal. And so it's fantastic to know that that's, you know, for many of us, years of therapy, there's something that just talking can't touch. And so having that physical experience of something different and having the experience of feeling differently in your body and having a different script when it comes to those sorts of interactions, whether it's just a verbal interaction where somebody is wanting more information or, you know, is just crossing boundaries that, you know, a lot of times for a lot of us as survivors, we don't even know we have those boundaries until they're crossed, right? And so having that conversation shift gives us that more openness, which, you know, many of us who are survivors are not survivors of only one assault or only one perpetrator. There are many built up on top of each other. So for me, you know, I can't speak for everyone, but for me, that experience of being in a classroom and having a change that went beyond where my brain could go consciously was profound for me, and it opened up a lot of other spaces.
We're talking to Alina Scheim of Impact Personal Safety. Well, now it's not called Impact Personal Safety anymore. It's called Impact.
It's true.
And there's an interesting reason for that. Why did you take those words off?
So for two primary reasons. One is that in 2008, we expanded our program significantly. We went from only teaching trauma-informed, social justice-based self-defense to teaching all forms of violence prevention. So actually 80 to 90% of what we do is in the schools at no cost and actually does not involve self-defense. It's earlier violence prevention. The other reason, so personal safety simply does not describe what we're doing. We're doing a lot of community safety work as well. The other piece is because of that controversy, it's hard when people hear personal safety, they immediately think self-defense, and they have no way of imagining that we work on bystander intervention or that we work on consent issues or we work on redefining healthy relationships and looking at healthy boundaries. It's to help people see us more quickly.
What is the bystander work about?
So one of the principles that we have at Impact, especially based in our background with self-defense, is that one needs to be able to know how to stand up for oneself before they can stand up for others. It's very unlikely. Most of us don't really like conflict for us to be able to go, oh, whatever is going on over there looks horrible. I think I'll go over there, right? And so we have a curriculum, especially what we call Walk the Talk, which is our anti-bias and anti-bullying programs that we do in the schools. We're doing all of DeVargas Middle School, thanks to a generous grant from the city of Santa Fe this year. And in that curriculum, we look at bias, discrimination, ally behavior. We look at racism, sexism, homophobia, etc. And we understand that vocabulary, do some empathy building, role plays in which we understand identities and how we're connected more, and that seeing those things are not bad. And then we do role plays in which we practice standing up for oneself and others. And the role play piece is significant. You know, we all have good intentions. It's not a lack of good intentions that makes things happen in the community when others are around. It's having skills to be able to be in that moment and get through the stress and get through the adrenaline and get through the fear of what others might think to be able to act.
When you do this work and there's what I guess is called, among other things, anti-bullying work, and you get a bunch of kids, middle school kids especially, are in such a transitional age. They're going through adolescence, mm-hmm. and under the very best of circumstances, it's a crazy time.
Right.
What happens in some of those interactions? Like, describe some scenarios of problems that come up and have the potential for being healed in your workshops.
Well, I think one of the foundational pieces is that folks know that it's complicated to talk about these issues, and no one has to have taught them to know. You know, one of the things that we'll do is we'll ask them to write down all of the insults that they've heard at their school. You know, the list is incredibly long, and we can see patterns that emerge.
Whether it was directed at them or somebody else.
Exactly. And then So they're very invested because we're talking about something that no one else is talking about or they're talking about. And, you know, the, like, just be nice, don't, you know, tell someone if that's happening. It doesn't really get to the crux of what students typically are hoping for. So what I like in the standing up for oneself exercise that we do is that they learn, we have the scale from microaggression, indirect verbal aggression, direct verbal aggression, and physical aggression. And then we have racism, sexism, homophobia, etc. And so they can choose their own scenarios. They can come up and say, I want a direct verbal aggression about being an immigrant. I want a microaggression about being a girl. And then we can practice scenarios, and it's very clear very, very quickly how real it is for them. And then what comes from that is, you know, I see relief. You know, you would think that you would see so much anxiety, but, you know, we just did it with the Boys and Girls Club not too long ago. And, you know, these boys that initially were very resistant about being there were going up and were like, I'm gonna get this. Like, this is my chance to deal with something I've been thinking about.
I mean, it's such a vulnerable and open age. And if you get people at that age, get them thinking, they're so smart.
Mm-hmm. They are. And they're so smart, and they have been looking for tools, right? When we look at people who have been, right, skipping school, who have been getting into what's called fights, who have been, you know, hiding after class, all these things, these are great brainstorming strategies that are being used by our youth. They're just looking for something that will not only work for them, because what they're seeing is that those skills are working for them, right? But also will help them maintain their self-esteem and feelings of self-worth and not get them into trouble.
So when you have a scenario set up and you're teaching somebody, like let's say you've got an immigrant kid
mm-hmm.
who's used to being insulted simply for being an immigrant kid,
mm-hmm.
and then you set up a role play,
mm-hmm.
like what happens? You set up a role play where somebody insults that kid. What
mm-hmm.
happens next?
Mm-hmm. Well, typically, I mean, for most of us without practice, we're going to have responses that are not what we would maybe intellectually think is the best idea.
Like, screw you.
Right. Or many other things I shouldn't say on the radio. Right. And so they may have that immediate impulse, and we've already gone over the skills and the strategies to use, and we'll do some character separation where we'll either have two instructors in the classroom and we'll have a coach, or and we'll have the person that's playing that, or we'll just have the one, in which case, if that's me, I'm going to lower my sunglasses and go, okay, how's this working out for you? Is this what you're really wanting to, you know, is this going in the direction that you want? And they know, right? They're immediately, you know, when it's a two instructor situation, the kids are so sweet. They'll look at me and they'll go, I don't know what to do because I'm going to hit them in a second, right? And I know I'm not supposed to do that.
Right.
And so, and then we get to a more effective response. You know, it involves
some
coaching.
And so what's a more
words.
Effective response?
So a more effective response, what I like is that we value everything ranging from, you know, some days I may say, you know, I don't want you saying that to me, and I want to tell you about me and my identity and everything that's not okay about you saying those sorts of things, right? We want to educate. And other days, depending on the context, depending on how we're feeling, it may just be, I need you to stop, right? And one of the things that I think is powerful about doing that from an anti-bias and anti-bullying place is to say, you know, I think you're saying that because I'm an immigrant, and that's not okay for me, right? Same thing.
Does that work? I mean, it sounds so Pollyanna.
It does sound Pollyanna, and that's why anti-bullying work, right, going back to community work versus individual work, must be done on a community-wide basis. That's why I'm thrilled we're in the entire middle school for DeVargas, because if a whole school gets that,
yeah,
that's really different than one child trying to change all the dynamics around them. We know that can't happen. We can stop the targeting for a moment. We can stay safe in that moment. But will that mean that the whole larger picture changes? No. Right? And so the New York chapter of Impact, where we got this curriculum, the Walk the Talk curriculum from, had a school in which they had been teaching self-defense for years, and they went in and taught the Walk the Talk curriculum in 7th grade. And in 8th grade, apparently someone went in to do anti-bullying work, and she went in and she said, so based on, with the 8th grader, she said, based on what I'm wearing and what I look like, what would you think about me? What would you say about me? And they said, well, we wouldn't. That wouldn't be a nice thing to do. We wouldn't do that. And she said, no, I'm giving you permission. Go ahead. And they were like, no, that wouldn't be being a good ally. We want to be good allies.
So they basically internalized it.
They internalized it. And the awesome, and I feel for her, right? She went back to the school and she said, I've been working with you all for years. This has worked every other year. Why is it not working? Right. And to me, that they wouldn't even do it for a class exercise, much less on recess, is really significant.
So does that translate? Like, do you have evidence that that translates onto the playground?
Mm-hmm. So this is based... Are you familiar with the brown eye, blue eye?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is actually work that's based on that understanding. So brown eye, blue eye, just quickly, is what is referring to after Martin Luther King was killed. There was a white teacher who was teaching in an all-white middle school, or actually elementary school. And her students understood that Martin Luther King did good work, and they said, why would someone kill him? And she thought about it, and she said, let me come back to you with that. And she came back and said, all of you who have blue eyes, sit in the back of the class. Put on these handkerchiefs around your neck. You are stupid. There's no way that you can become more smart. Everyone suddenly started ostracizing them on recess. They did badly on their quizzes that day, to the extent that a student came up to her and said, how could you be a teacher? You have blue eyes, right?
Right, and what's amazing is the kids internalized the prejudice instantly.
Instantly.
It happened in one day. It happened in 5 minutes.
Yeah. And then they reversed it, right?
Yeah, the next day,
they did the same thing to brown-eyed kids. And afterwards, they talked about it. And what's amazing is that they looked at those same students, you know, decades later, and what they found is that they experienced far less prejudice and discrimination than others in terms of what they thought and what they put out into the world.
Yeah.
And so that's the pattern that we're going for with our training, is it's not enough to just have an intellectual understanding of something. You have to have that felt experience. Now, we may have concerns about the trauma associated with doing that in a way that students don't know is a game.
Yeah, I mean, that teacher would have lost her job
right.
if she'd been doing it today.
Right. And so, obviously, when we do it, we're really clear. This is a role play. This is an exercise. Here are the circumstances. I'm going to put a label on your back and treat you a certain way, and we'll talk about why afterwards.
We're talking to Alina Scheim of IMPACT, which is a violence prevention and self-defense group here, based here in Santa Fe, and there's IMPACTs all over the country.
There are.
And they're all sort of connected and independent in a pretty cool way.
Yeah.
There has been a lot of controversy about these devices and products that have been invented and occasionally even marketed, but you see these things online, like anti-rape underwear, anti-rape belts, anti-rape nail polish. Mm-hmm. I'm like, anti-rape nail polish? What do you scratch them and it pour, you know? Right. But it turns out that it's like it's a chemical that detects date-raped rugs, so you can dip your finger in your drink. And there's a lot of controversy about those products. First of all, on a cursory search of the internet, it seems that there's really no evidence one way or the other that they have been successfully used.
Mm-hmm.
They're talked about. People fight about them sort of ad nauseum, mm-hmm. but it's not clear that enough people have used them for there to be any evidence about whether they work. What do you think about that whole set of devices and products?
Well, for us, it comes back to the understanding of safety myths and where danger is and where it isn't, as well as control of women and women's bodies. And so, you know, with the anti-rape nail polish in particular, which is the most recent product that came out.
And it hasn't even come out yet.
Yes, yes. That has been talked about. The most recent that has been talked about is that only 2% of rapes are facilitated by what's called date rape drugs, Rohypnol, etc. The vast majority of rapes happen without that. So it's preparing for these circumstances in which, as you and I have talked about, is there's this feeling that, well, when would I stir my drink? I would only stir my drink in settings in which I was already suspicious that someone might try to drug me. I wouldn't stir my drink if this was someone that I know and care about and have feelings for, and it's consensual up until it's not consensual anymore, which is what most rape is. Obviously, rape of children and sexual assault of children is different. And so that is one of the major critiques of those products. The other critique is that it's asking women to change their behaviors. It's asking them to put on nail polish when they may not express their femininity in that way. They may chew their nails, right? There's so many different pieces around that. They're asking women to change their lives in not insignificant ways many times.
I was looking at that controversy and I was thinking, well, you know, I think that society should be educated not to do burglary. But meanwhile, I've got locks on all my doors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is some appropriate, going about your life normally, but taking precautions, whether that precaution is locking your door or learning the self-defense techniques at Impact or whatever. I mean, it's not entirely against what we do in all sorts of other situations in our lives, because in fact we live in a world that is dangerous in so many different ways.
It's true, and that's why self-defense, even empowerment-based self-defense, oftentimes gets lumped in with all these other precautions is because of that similarity that you described, which is taking precautions even though we do want to educate and to make it so that sexual assault simply just stops. However, what I would say is that what I notice and feel differently is that taking a class that takes two weekends to learn all the skills that I need to know for life, muscle memory makes it so that those skills stay with me. I can use them if they're people that I know. I can use them if they're strangers. That feels so much better to me than going, okay, I'm putting on my anti-rape underwear today because I think this might happen. One of them makes me feel happy and secure and actually reinforces my ability to have conversations with people I know that make me feel like a stronger person, get the quality of life that I want. And one of them, in fact, makes me feel fearful, doesn't address the danger that is most likely, and undermines me living the life that I want.
I would think it's also, to some extent, context dependent. I mean, if you were a female in a war zone, and there's all sorts of stories about women veterans and, well, women soldiers getting raped by their own fellow male soldiers, you might think a little differently about it than if you're a civilian Santa Fe and walking around a relatively safe town.
Yes, and what I would say about both of those setups is that they're not addressing that the most common sexual assault is by someone that I trust and that I don't anticipate there being problems with. So it's very likely the underwear is coming off because I've decided that I want to be sexual with this person, that I decided not even to put on the anti-rape underwear because I feel trust with this person, right? And so that's where I think all of those things, if it were stranger danger, I wouldn't really have a problem with a lot of the products that are out there, but it's not.
So when you teach these classes, and again, I've taken one of those two-weekend classes some years ago, and there are refresher classes afterwards and follow-up classes for people who've done the first training. Let's say a woman comes into the class who has been sexually assaulted or sexually traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
Does she relive that in the course of the class? And if she does, how do you deal with it?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So for our public classes, over half of our students have experienced some kind of violence before they've taken the class. And so the reason why we call our classes trauma-informed is we know no one comes with a blank slate. Even if you haven't had a personal history of violence, we've lived in a culture that this is a very present part of life, especially for women. And so in our classes, we do a lot to make the class safe. We have separated roles that I alluded to earlier. So someone like me leads the class, teaches the majority of the information, practices with students, and then is there coaching them through all of the scenarios. The other instructor does a lot of what I do and also plays the role of someone who's crossing verbal or physical boundaries. There's chances to check in at the beginning of class and at the end of the class. We set up partners to be able to have even more support systems. And everything that we do, which is really critical with PTSD, is we see it, we drill it, and then we do it. There's nothing that is ever going to happen in a classroom that you don't see beforehand. So for many people with trauma, that is the biggest feature of trauma, is not knowing what's about to happen. And so what's great about that is that I can say, oh, I'm watching this right now. That looks kind of intense. That looks scary. Oh, it's being broken down. Okay, I'm practicing the moves. I'm practicing this in just a low-key scenario. Okay, now I'm going into this other setting. So while it's possible, of course, to be thinking about this, for memories to come up, for thoughts to come up, all of those things make it so that it's a safer environment. We also are happy to talk with people before classes about their concerns, and, you know, have breaks. We talk about it being an emotion-friendly class. All emotions are welcome, tears, anger, not feeling much of anything. So it's actually quite rare. While it is common for people to take the class with experiences and with trauma histories, it's quite rare for it to show up in a way that feels harmful to someone. Most of the time, if it happens, there's the support in the class that says, okay, yes, of course, I may have this moment in the class, right? When I took the class, one of the most powerful things for me to learn is that I could cry and I could defend myself and change the scenario at the same time.
Very interesting. What led you to this work yourself?
As a young person, I had experienced violence, and my first dating relationships were abusive, and I knew I needed to do something about it. And so I tried out martial arts. I took several self-defense classes, all with people with really good intentions, but I was quite aware that it was not a safe place to experience emotions. It, in fact, did not deal with the things that I wanted to deal with, which was sexual assault and situations with people that I knew. And so I kept taking classes. You know, I have a lot of admiration for my teenage self. I have no idea how she was so resilient, but I kept taking classes, and I moved here to Santa Fe. I started working at Esperanza at the domestic violence shelter, and I took a class with Impact, and everything shifted for me. I was really living in a place of fear, and really, you know, I didn't even in the summertime here with no swamp cooler, I didn't even want to leave the window open. My housemates wanted to kill me. They loved me so much, but they wanted to kill me. And afterwards, I started traveling. I started salsa dancing, which is a situation I would have never felt safe in or comfortable in before. And it changed my life entirely. So I was really excited to make the shift from crisis work to healing and prevention.
If people want to find out more information, give us the website and tell us a little bit about your upcoming events.
Mm-hmm. Our website is impactpersonalsafety.org. We don't have it out of there yet. And our phone number is 992-8833. We have upcoming classes. We have just a one-day, four-hour workshop that's a nice one just to get your feet wet and get some skills, especially if you have a young person who's about to go on a trip or you just want to check it out. And that one's October 4th. It's a mixed-gender class. We have classes that are both for women and for mixed-gender. We have a 20-hour mixed gender basics, which is the two-weekend format that we spoke of, that's also in October 18th, 19th, 25th, and 26th. And then we have a children's class, which is really fun and really sweet for 6 to 12-year-olds, which is November 8th and 9th.
Alina Scheim is the executive director of Impact, once again on the web at impactpersonalsafety.org.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.